So back in 1993, when I had just finished my theological studies, I went back to Invercargill, to the Presbytery of Southland, the presbytery that had sent me for my training in order to be licensed. And it was quite a big deal. The presbytery was always very glad when people from their area had prepared through ministry training, and this was their opportunity to celebrate and to give to their student a license to be a minister. And so it's quite a formal moment at the presbytery. And one of the senior ministers is charged with giving a sermon and a message to those being licensed to set them on their way in ministry. And so it is really quite an important time. In those days, you can imagine the presbytery would often be quite well dressed, the suits, the ties, the gowns, the collars, all of that was a part of it. And the senior minister was giving the advice to me about how to have my ministry and to start my ministry. And he said, in the midst of this, which was quite different, he said, "Remember to drink some wine." I've forgotten all the rest of the advice that had been given to me at the time. This really seemed to stand out. I was soon to become a minister, listening for some deeply spiritual advice. My ministry was about to take off, and the advice was, drink some wine. Now, you may know, I'm not a teetotaler, but I don't really drink very much, but I've always thought it might be a good excuse if I was stopped for drunk driving to be able to say, my minister told me to drink. Well, the wedding at Cana is an amazing story, and it's rich in detail. As that story was being read, did you notice the tension between Jesus and his mother? Did you see the problem that the young married couple had running out of wine in the middle of their celebration? Did you notice the purification jars there for holding water and wondering why weren't they full? Or perhaps asking, once they were filled with wine, could they ever be used for purification again? Did you sense the delight in the master of ceremonies tasting this wine and yet being ignorant of where it had come from? As you heard this story, did you recognize the extravagant gift that Jesus had given to this young couple, which would come to almost 1,000 bottles of the finest wine? Or did you wonder, why so much wine? So there's a lot that's happening in this story of this first miraculous sign in Jesus' ministry. Is there any significance in the setting being a wedding feast? Does anything other than the quality of the wine lie behind the statement, you have saved the best till now? And does this in any way relate to what we know of Jesus saying about himself, I am the true vine? So as we think about this, we'll take first of all a look at the sign itself. So and try to have some context to this. We know that Jesus' disciple Nathanael was from Cana. So this was his hometown in which this miracle took place. We also know that Cana was only about 6 kilometers from Nazareth, where Jesus grew up. And so there would have been plenty of interaction between these villages. Perhaps we detect a little bit of small town rivalry when Nathanael hears about Jesus first of all and says, Nazareth, can anything good come from Nazareth? It's quite reasonable that we understand with the proximity that an invitation would be given to Mary and Jesus and to his disciples to be invited to this wedding. There was a real sense of hospitality at this time in the ancient world. And there we find ourselves in Nathanael's hometown. And so we have this sign, and it's taking place at a wedding. I like a good wedding. My own wedding day was a really wonderful celebration. We had fancy suits, we had top hats. The ceremony took place in a church rebuilt in 1882, with parts of it dating back to the 12th century. We had a sumptuous feast at the palatial Craythorne Hall. And that's before I mention my beautiful bride, Melanie. Weddings are among the most wonderful celebrations that families and communities have. Times of joy, times of celebration. And so it's quite fitting that a wedding is the occasion for Jesus' first sign. In the Old Testament, a feast is used to symbolize God's blessing on the people. And so in Isaiah we read, on this mountain, the Lord Almighty will prepare a rich feast of food for all peoples, a banquet of aged wine, the best of meats, and the finest of wines. Can you imagine the wonderful heavenly feast, the joy, the happiness, the celebration that Isaiah is talking about here, that sense of gladness? Isaiah reminds us, when God provides the wine, it is the finest of wines. And when Jesus provides this finest wine at this feast, it's a foretaste of the prophesied heavenly feast that Isaiah was talking about. And in his own teaching, Jesus likened himself to a bridegroom and used this imagery in his parable, saying, the kingdom of heaven is like a king who prepared a wedding banquet for his son. And then if we think towards the end of the New Testament, in Revelation, there's a cosmic celebration, this wedding feast of the Lamb. And we read, let us rejoice and be glad and give him glory, for the wedding of the Lamb has come, and his bride has made herself ready. Then the angel said to me, write, blessed are those who are invited to the wedding supper of the Lamb. And just as an aside, I wonder and I ask you, do you have an invitation to the wedding feast of the Lamb? Have you stepped into his kingdom and become part of his family, that you would receive this invitation to be there when Jesus gathers with all his people, a time of exceeding joy? And of course, all of this from Isaiah through Jesus through Revelation fits in really well with what Jesus is doing at this time at the wedding at Cana. The sign itself, though, is relatively low-key. It's not a flashy thing that happens. The moment that the water is turned into wine isn't accompanied by some great prayer or the laying on of hands or some extravagant fanfare, ta-da, here it is. But rather, Jesus seems almost to expend no energy at all in doing this. It's quite a discreet sign. It was noticed by the servants who put the water into the jars, by Jesus' mother, by the disciples, but no one else at the wedding really has an inkling as to what is going on. Being low-key, it doesn't distract from the celebrations of the young couple getting married. It doesn't stand out to become the main event of that day. And while the master of the banquet declares it to be the finest of wine, he doesn't know that it has been provided by the master of God's own great celebratory feast, the Son of God. Also, the focus on wine is important. In the Old Testament, wine is used as a symbol of God's blessing. Also, just a little warning there, because wine is also used in a negative sense, particularly with regard to drunkenness, and that being a sign of sin and waywardness from God. But there are times when it is used as a blessing. And so in Joel, we read, in that day, this is the day of the Lord, in that day, the mountains will drip with new wine, and the hills will flow with milk. All the ravines of Judah will run with water. And Amos also picks up this imagery of the future good promises of God and says, the days are coming, declares the Lord, when the reaper will be overtaken by the plowman and the planter overtaken by the one treading grapes. New wine will drip from the mountains and flow from all the hills. I will bring back my exiled people, Israel. They will rebuild the ruined cities and live in them. They will plant vineyards and drink their wine. They will make gardens and eat their fruit. And so this sense in the Old Testament of mountains that are dripping with wine, a sense of great abundance, where even as the plowman is, even as the person's gathering in the grapes, the plowman's coming along because it's going to be such a rich harvest. They're starting again straight away. The planter is being overtaken by the one who's already treading the grapes. There's just so much and such abundance. And those who are familiar with Jesus will remember that he spoke of his gospel being like new wine that needed to be poured into new wineskins. And of course, in the New Testament, we have the institution of the Last Supper, where Jesus links the wine to his blood poured out for the forgiveness of all. So that's the sign in the context, but what does it point to really? Well, last Sunday, I invited you to look ahead at one or two of the signs and to try and see what you thought they might be pointing to. Some of you might have looked at this sign, and I wonder what you may have concluded. There are a lot of things happening here that you could rightly have looked at. You could legitimately conclude that it's pointing to the fulfillment of Old Testament prophecies in Isaiah and Joel and Amos. In Jesus, God was fulfilling those things that had been promised earlier. Or you might look at the purification jars, symbols of the Old Testament laws, jars possibly empty as an indication of the emptiness of Judaism and the need for Jesus to provide a new covenant, thinking about the new wine that would fill them. Or you might have thought it's pointing to Jesus' creative power because he's able to deal and to change these very elements. Or again, some of you may have thought it's pointing to the extravagant abundance of wine as a sign of God's extravagant blessings for his people. And the sign of turning water into wine does point to all of this and to more. And some of you may have noticed this. John himself points to the meaning that is behind this sign. It's Jesus revealing his glory so that disciples will believe in him. We read this, the first of his miraculous signs Jesus performed at Cana in Galilee. He thus revealed his glory, and his disciples put their faith in him. And this echoes what we were thinking about last week, and we find towards the end of the gospel, where John says, Jesus did many other miraculous signs in the presence of his disciples, which are not recorded in this book. But these are written that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ. These signs are here so you may know Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that believing you might have life in his name. Of course, Jesus did many other miraculous signs. All the signs that John records, the signs that are in the other Gospels, signs that weren't recorded at all, point towards Jesus and his glory, who he is as the Son of God, with the idea that it will inspire people to put their trust, their belief, their hope in him, and so have eternal life. Looking back at the wedding, John concludes, Jesus here has revealed his glory. And what does that mean? When I was a young Christian, we sang a chorus. Maybe those of a certain age would remember, I've got a home in glory land that outshines the sun, way beyond the blue. And when I think of glory, generally I think of a bright shining light, the radiance of God's being that we will see when we're with God through eternity. But at this miracle, there's no blinding light. In fact, Jesus doesn't stand out at all. He seems to have been one among many guests. The happy couple themselves were the center of attention. So what does glory mean in this context? Glory is about the presence of God. And that's what Jesus brought to this wedding. Although veiled in human flesh, looking much the same as everyone else, Jesus was and is God. In some respects, Jesus could get lost in a crowd. Isaiah prophesied about him. He had no beauty or majesty to attract us to him, nothing in his appearance that we should desire him. If someone was called upon to give a description of Jesus, what would they say? Medium height, medium build, no distinguishing features. He just doesn't stand out. If you hadn't met with Jesus before, perhaps the only way to have known him in those days would have been to look for the one who was doing the miracles, or to look for the one who was giving the teaching of the gospel. And this sign pointed to who Jesus really was. The power that Jesus used was a sign to understand that he was the Son of God. It's to glimpse his glory. Now, no one else would have known except that John recorded this for us, so his readers could know and believe through this sign that Jesus is the Son of God. So as we conclude, we're able to focus on this main point, that the sign is done so Jesus' glory is revealed, so that we begin to glimpse that he is the Son of God. And then we can bring in all those other layers of added richness around that sign, that the new wine of the gospel replaces the water of the law, the extravagance of the blessings from the hand of God, this overflow of wine, 680 or so liters of wine being provided. The wine is a symbol for the new covenant, his blood poured out for us, the fulfillment of prophecies, the foretaste of the wedding feast that is yet to come, and Jesus being the true vine who provides the best wine. And all of this is reason for us and for his disciples to believe. And so I invite you to take a little time, perhaps, to reflect on this today. I know that some of you are partial to a little wine. So perhaps this afternoon, if you sit down with a glass of wine or grape juice and read this passage and try to understand and to delve into it, perhaps trying to put yourself in the place of one of the servants who put the water in the container, who drew it out, or one of the disciples seeing Jesus' first sign of power, to open our eyes to see, our spirit to believe, Jesus truly is the Son of God. Amen.